This is adult church this morning, sometimes referred to as big church, and that is certainly a big church or an adult reading. That's not the sort of passage that kids' church or the teenagers go to. There's a lot in this. I'm going to start with very hands-on, talking about stones, and then end with the practical advice that Jesus gives in that teaching. In September, I got to walk around the raised foundation platform of the Jerusalem temple. So I was in the same area that conversation happened today. We're talking about a stone platform that's 35 acres or 14 and a half hectares big. And Basically, it's the top of a mountain which has been made flat and built up to create this vast area. Jesus visited the temple there several times in his lifetime. And the last time was leading to his death, just a short distance from there. Now, before I say anything more about the temple and the feelings around it, I need to bring you into an open secret. It's a secret that Jesus was saying again and again and again, and nobody was getting until after the resurrection. And even today, a lot of people don't get it. The secret simply is, I'll say it now and I'll say it again, Jesus is the replacement of the temple. Temple was coming down, Jesus was coming up. Now, to understand what this means, it's about the meeting place with God. And from the time of Moses, there had been a designated place to worship. God's people hadn't just been, you know, given an open sheet, and as if the Lord Almighty said, well, you can worship me any way you want. You can be creative. No, there were specific instructions that were appropriate to the nature of God and their relationship together. So it started in the desert with the tabernacle, and it went with them through the desert and then stood for nearly 396 to be precise, nearly 400 years at a place called Shiloh. And it stood there, this tent, as the place of meeting. From here, Solomon got to build a temple. And this is when David, you know, centralized the Jewish nation on Jerusalem. And the temple became the place to meet God. And the scriptures talk about God designating this as a place where he was pleased for his name to dwell. And the temple of Solomon was splendid. And it stood for about 400 years, from 957 BC until the Babylonians destroyed it in 538 BC. So this was the place to meet God. Within a generation, the exiles came back and they started to rebuild a temple. And it wasn't as impressive as the temple of Solomon. It was, let's say, kind of basic, but it was their temple until Herod the Great. Now we're starting to get into familiar territory. Herod the Great, just before Jesus' time, Herod the Great was a builder. I think that's probably why he's called the Great. And all through the land of Israel, there are massive projects that he started. He thought he could change the world by building. And he set his eyes on the temple. And so he threw his considerable energy and resources into taking this temple of Solomon and making it magnificent. And the Jewish people weren't too keen on Herod in every way, but in this regard, they threw everything into it. So, by the time that Jesus and his dusty friends from Galilee arrived, it was magnificent beyond all telling. It was splendid in architecture. It had been made beautiful. There were dramatic, what we would call artworks and installations and decor, gold, precious stones, Nothing had been held back. It was stunning. That's what Jesus and his disciples came to. So they were amazed. And apparently there was so much gold on top of it that when you came from a distance, it would be shining in the sun. This was a suitable place to meet with God. I came to what was left a few months ago. And I noted that the disciples commented on what magnificent stones. I'm one of these people, stones speak to me. These bricks here don't say much. But something about really big stones, really monolithic structures speak to me. This is just one cornerstone, and your eye can run along it to recognize that's about as big as a minibus. The biggest stone in the base of the temple is over 12 meters long. It's over 3.5 meters high and 4 meters deep, estimated to weigh around 500 tons. That's 2 fully loaded jet aircraft. Now, people still don't know how they did it. They got these stones from quarries, shifted them here, put them in place. So, like the disciples of Jesus, I stood there looking at these things thinking, that's impressive. That's impressive at a very basic male level of appreciation. Guys, you're with me, aren't you? There was no wallpaper to admire, but there were these huge stones. And that says something. They're still there. So the temple's gone. Just the foundation and the basement, as it were, is there. And it impresses me. It impressed the disciples. Jesus, remember, is saying, trying to let people know, this splendid place, I'm the replacement. That's coming down. I'm coming up. That's the place that the nation has always sought to meet God. That's where God's presence has been encountered. I'm the replacement. It's an amazing statement, isn't it? And no wonder no one got it. How could you capture that one? His disciples didn't get it. But we're going to take you a bit into the story. So, it's in John chapter 2 that Jesus says this explicitly. He says, destroy this temple. But he says it in a roundabout way, as he often does in John's Gospel. Destroy this temple, and in 3 days I will raise it up. The Jewish authorities then said, it has taken 46 years to build this temple, and you will raise it in 3 days. But he was talking about the temple of his body. That 46 years is a reference to the work of Herod, that Herod had begun 46 years ago, and it was almost finished. It was almost so good. This is the clue that made sense after the resurrection. So if you are saying you've got this splendid prestige project, this symbol of the nation, this place to meet God, this project that has taken everything that the nation could bring, and Jews from all over the Jewish world were contributing to it, and you are saying, I'm the replacement, you're going to raise a few eyebrows. Be that religiously, business-wise, culturally, you are saying that everything that has been worked on, everything that has been held dear, is about to be undone, and I'm the replacement. So, he would become the place, Jesus, where God and humanity met. He would become the place where atonement was made for sin. He would become the place where people would experience the presence of God. It brings to mind C.S. Lewis, doesn't it? Lord, liar, or lunatic. It's an incredible claim. So Jesus is standing there with his disciples on this visit, and he speaks with the knowledge that within a generation, that would all come down. Not a stone would be left on a stone. That's what he prophesied. So if Jesus was there around 33 AD, by 70 AD it had happened. On schedule. And the occasion was the first Jewish revolt against the Romans. And in 70 AD, the Romans laid siege to Jerusalem, which for about 3 or 4 years had been independent, run by the rebels. And they set out to mark their total conquest of Jerusalem. One of the things they did was, and this is looking at the Western Wall, I took this photo from the corner of the south and the west. They started like schoolboys throwing rocks, huge rocks, off from the top. And for the best part of the 2,000 years, 1,900 years really, they, you know, all the dust and the dirt and the rubble had built up on top. Until in the last generation, when that was removed, there they were, as the Romans had toppled them over. And the Israelis had decided to leave them there. They're not going to clean them up, because that's history. And for us, it's modern history. It connects what we've been reading this morning. The Romans weren't going to leave stone on stone, and they pushed them over the edge. Tongue in cheek, a stone that was 12 metres long, they didn't bother with. You know, they picked their stones. But everything that they could throw from the top, they did. And they're still there to be seen today, exactly where they fell. So, to interpret this, Jesus in this passage today, and it's a tough passage, was speaking about the next generation in which he would replace the temple and it would be destroyed. And the lead up to that, he was saying, would be horrendous. This would be a time of turmoil, of tribulation, of great suffering, great struggle. And being a Jew, talking to Jew, he said there will be signs, there will be indicators in the heavens and upheavals and vast turbulence. So that is the specific context. And as a faith tourist, it was very special to actually see the stones, because they speak of this. And into this, Jesus gives some very specific teaching. There are 6 points to this. They're all going to be on the website probably by this afternoon. So if you want to take notes, that's fine, but they'll be available on our church website. There are 6 points of teaching that Jesus gives for that time, for a time where that's going to end in the destruction of the temple. Something horrific for Jews and his disciples. So, the instruction he gives for that first generation applies to us too, because we are anticipating a time of difficulty before Jesus returns. It's so often the case with prophecy or with teaching, it had a specific setting, but its application may extend to another time as well. So, what does he say? What are the practicalities? Well, I've got them here in note form. Firstly, don't be unduly perturbed by what seems to be catastrophic political upheavals. Isn't that good advice for today? The order is in turmoil. Don't be worried about it. Sometimes I hear Christians saying, this happened, we've got to pray for this, we've got to pray for that. Whereas what I hear Jesus saying is, don't worry about it. The Jewish war of revolt, and there were two of them, the first and then the second one again, and the destruction of the temple were absolutely catastrophic for the Jewish nation. It was a wound that bled for 1900 years. And yet Jesus is quite explicit. Even such a catastrophic event does not undermine or shake the purposes of God. Keep your eye on God's purposes. Now, we live in a world where, I don't know if you have this feeling, anything could happen. It's increasingly getting like that. It's unstable. Don't worry. Don't worry. God's purposes aren't bothered by this. Secondly, in uncertain times, Jesus teaches, his followers are bound to face opposition. Follow Jesus, it's a sure indication that you will face opposition. When things are being shaken and people feel insecure, they will look for scapegoats. And whether it's Jews or Christians, that's to be expected. God's people will face difficult times when there's uncertainty. Don't be surprised, is the teaching. Don't be surprised. And I see that in small measure in our context today. When there is uncertainty, when there is the prospect of the order breaking down, for some reason, it's been Jews and lately as well Christians who are persecuted. Don't be surprised. Don't be caught out. Thirdly, this is a time for testimony. This is a time to have open mouths. It's a time to speak with confidence about the good news of Jesus and to trust the Spirit of God that he will guide and direct in speech and action. And he tells us, don't have a prepared speech. Don't have your speaking cards, as it were, ready. Well, that's so last century, isn't it? You'd have them on an iPhone now or something. No. Be courageous and trust that God will tell you what to say in the opportunities that come. There's a picture building, isn't there? This might be a very strange world, but Jesus recognized it was coming in the generation after him, and it's been a feature of Christian history ever since. Fourthly, it's time to be rooted in the teaching of Jesus and not be blown off course by various other teachings claiming to be from him. It's a time to be close to the gospel and not drift away. Boy, is that relevant. I think the polite term is revisionism. So the gospel and the Christian faith has been revised all over the place. It's particularly hot in North America. And Jesus is saying, in these times of uncertainty, you know, don't go and reinvent the gospel. Don't attribute teachings to me that aren't from me. Don't listen to people who say, I am the Messiah, or I have a new revelation. Hold fast. Stay close to Jesus. One particular way that applies to us here in Trinity Church, where we have 30 to 40 nations of origin, we have Eastern, African, the rest of us cultures operating. Those cultures and those cultural imperatives must not replace the teachings of Jesus. Jesus says, is to be our focus of orientation. So don't be blown off course by various teachings is the fourth instruction. Fifth one, this circumstance, the generation following him and that time before the end will be a time of division, even within households. Parents and children, brothers and sisters, in a time of stress and uncertainty and looming catastrophe, even these bonds between family members will be split. That's how intense this can be. And Jesus is saying that's what you are to expect. It's not easy. And it reminds us that he said this with reference to an image somewhere, I came to bring a sword. I am divisive, is what Jesus is saying. It's a very popular agenda to have unity at all costs. Can't we just get on? Can't we just keep the arrangement together? And Jesus is saying, no, well, the closer you, the more intense it gets, the more divisive I will be. It's not easy, is it? That's why we don't talk about this in kids' church. And sixthly, the final bit of advice that Jesus gives is endurance. There is an end. Hang on. Hang on. And the ones who hang on to the end, who endure to the end, will save their souls. That process or that experience of endurance will save your souls. It is a good thing. So the house is a bit quiet now, and that's understandable because this is heavy stuff. But as Jesus often said to people, I don't want you to be in the dark. I'm telling you up front. And he was speaking the words, but it was as if it wasn't going in, wasn't landing. What does it take for it to land? Pain. Pain. It takes pain, or it's just me, to get through so that the words make sense. They need to be, as it were, they need to come home with some punch. So, to round off, we are living in a different moment, but there is a connection. Jesus was speaking about the last days before the fall of the temple. We are in the last days before his return. And people can get overexcited in that phase, interpreting the signs, the earthquakes, the wars, the rumors of war. All these things can, be overinterpreted. But let's focus on what Jesus instructs us as to how to live in times that of uncertainty and in times when cataclysm or disaster is imminent. Okay, so what remains for us today is to recognize and honor God's purposes in Jesus, no matter what distressing signs and disasters may take place. And I think as a person who grew up in fairly stable political circumstances, and we still live in fairly stable political circumstances here, it's very easy to assume that the order in which we live, the economy, the currency, the legal protections, the military security, is, as it were, what we should be praying for, what we should be seeking at all costs. They're good things. They're good things. But Jesus' message here is your focus is to be on him, his words, and God's purposes. Even to the point where when there is the potential to be particularly unpopular or be persecuted, be prepared to open your mouth to Jesus. So, that's what I have to bring from that passage. Do go and read it again. It's Luke chapter 21. And if you go to the website and perhaps comb through those 6 points and match them with what Jesus said, you can test it. Is that actually his instruction? My belief is we need to have the attitude that we are living in the last days. There is no guarantee that the order in which we live will continue. Just to underline that, apparently there have been 21 civilizations in the history, the known history of the world. 21 civilizations. And they've all done the same thing. Every single one of them. There's no guarantee. So whatever institutions or pillars of world order we think we rely on, when Jesus was speaking about the temple, he was talking about something of that order. Something so solid, so grand, so right. And yet he was saying, I'm the replacement. And as that time of replacement comes, or for our ears, as the return of the Lord draws near, you need to be looking at me. Don't work to be propping up the existing arrangement, or trying to find your salvation in existing institutions. Look to me, be prepared to stand for me, and by all that is in you, hold on until the end. Shall we pray? You may want a minute just to, as it were, place yourself in what's been said, and perhaps ask, how ready or active are you in standing in and for Jesus?